Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Trankelberg, and Andre Kleiner is on the line. Hey, Andre.
Hello, Fred.
Hey. You know, we noticed that in between when we were just getting started that we're both just recovering from colds. It seems to be the season. I don't know if it does it make it, at least in my own head, it makes me sound like I have a better voice, more gravelly and deeper voice. And you sound pretty good.
Oh, good. So maybe we should get more of recordings while during the cold season.
I don't know, though. It might just be in my head because I'm, you know, a little bit head cold, stuffed up, and my ears are plugged up a little bit. So maybe I just can't hear it.
Can't hear it well. No, I don't know. But to me, you sound fine. So
No problem. Sounds good. So we're recovering, but it's seasonal. And I've heard a lot of people have been, it's kind of the kids are back in school and everybody's sharing their germs and it's the season. So it happens. But, you know, and it's almost something you can predict, right? You know that we travel some in the fall, we get people back in school. It's almost every year I catch some kind of cold or something like that, that about this time of year as the weather changes. But it's something, even though I know it, it's coming, I don't take preventative measures, right? I don't wash my hands more. I don't have more vitamin C. I don't use that information in any useful way. I just kind of deal with it as it happens. But in reliability, you know, in reliability world.
That's why we need prediction, right?
That's right. Well, I don't know. It's only useful if you do something with it. And I think there's a flip side to that, though, with reliability prediction in our work, is that it also has to be useful. It has to actually mean something. And you know my position on like Mill Handbook 217 and MTBF in general, but even Mill Handbook 217, which gives you uses failure rates, constant failure rates for all kinds of components. You add it all up and you get a failure rate at the end of the day. It's not terribly useful for what most people, I find, and that's what's frustrating to me, is they use it to predict the future performance of a product.
Oh, yeah. People kind of grab that number and run with it, and it's just scary to think what they're going to do with this. And I think we had one of the recordings when we talked a little bit about reliability prediction, but So I might repeat myself saying that this activity was actually on its way out until the resurgence of functional safety standards. So right. Now we have those functional safety standards coming out of Europe, where one of the activities you need to calculate what's called ACIL or SIL, which stands for safety and integrity level. And part of that calculation is you need to calculate what's called fit rate or failure rate,
right,
which is exactly what you're saying, based on the constant failure rate exponential model, which we know how well that one works.
Right.
And your favorite topic of MTBF. But it's a reality we have to deal with. And after functional safety, we now start seeing a lot more of that activity, even where functional safety is not involved, where your customer basically asking you to provide your fit rates or failure rates before the hardware is built, and like only you have a drawing, so bill of materials, and say, now okay, give me the failure rate, and that is exactly what you were saying, based on parts count and individual components failure rates, which really the number you get at the end is not going to be terribly useful.
Well, that's where I think you and I tend to agree, and I remember you, and I think it was in our previous episode, we talked about that it's not useful for the way people use it. Is if you use a parts count prediction and you get a number, you get a failure rate or you get an MTBF value, it's not suitable to put on your data sheet to say, well, here's how long it's going to last. Here's its probability of failure. That's pure fiction in that regard. And there's papers and studies that have shown that it's just bollocks. It's just crazy number for that application.
Right. And in when you use, and you know, there's a lot of different sources, we call handbook based prediction, mm-hmm. Where like the one you mentioned, Mill Handbook 217, there's a Telcordia, there's FIDES, there's Siemens, there's ISO 62380. Mm-hmm. And one kind of really strong argument against using this would be if you take five or six of those standards and run the same type of circuit or say same type of system and calculate your fit rates, you're all going to be different. And in some cases, they may differ like two orders of magnitude.
Oh, yeah, or more. And the other part is, I can understand they're different because they're pulling from different databases and different applications. But if you take two telecommunications-based standards and give it to four different people, you'll get four different answers.
Exactly, yes.
And so the procedure itself, it's got flaws in it. The databases themselves are flawed. And I think my biggest complaint with it, and some are trying to say that they're adjusting to that and adapting to it, is that the failure rates are not constant. Capacitors wear out, mechanical systems wear out, things age, things drift, things...
Even ICs wearing out, which is especially like a newer ICs with a smaller feature size. We see like due to electromigration and other things and even diffusion, kind of making them wear out sooner. But we're not even at that level yet. Even just if we assume a constant failure rate, which we know is not a very strong assumption, but even when we stay within the concept of constant failure rate, there's still so much diversity in so much erroneous data you can get the erroneous results. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, I remember your co-author Pat O'Connor. He was at a doing a panel with Greg Hobbs out here in the Bay Area years and years ago, and somebody asked him about predictions, and Pat related the story that he goes, "Don't waste your time." he was adamant. And he said, here's why. He says, when I was in the Air Force, in the British Air Force, I was a radio repairman, right? And I would get these boxes in and I'd have to sort out what was wrong with it and repair it and put it back on the shelf, test it, and it go back out into the fleet. And one of the steps was to gather information about what failed. And he learned later that data he was collecting was being used to populate this parts count prediction methods. And he said, I know firsthand that the data going into that was crazy because we would do 10 repairs and I had no idea which part replaced, fixed anything. I just was replacing parts and getting it working again and, you know, doing my best to repair radios.
The door, yeah.
And then I do all the paperwork at the end of the day. And we learned very quickly that if you always pick the same component, the supervisor would yell at you. So we picked random things on the sheet. He says that the source data going into these things was suspect. And he says he didn't say for sure, but he says he believed that he wasn't the only one doing that. Although maybe he was. He's got that kind of guy.
I think this was pretty close to the truth. In fact, speaking of Pat, we had an argument when we were working on the fifth edition of Practical Reliability Engineering because he wanted to take all this reliability prediction stuff out of the book because of exactly the same reason, because it's a waste of time. And fortunately, I was able to convince him to actually leave the stuff there and add a lot more because what was in the previous edition was mostly Mill Handbook 217. And we added a whole section on different reliability prediction methods.
Well, you talk about FIDES and Telcordia, and there's like a list of different ones, and they're different strengths, weaknesses kind of thing.
Right, and that's what we added in the book, not because it gives you tremendous value. It's just because it's out there. I mean, if you work in the industry, you would be asked to do a reliability prediction using probably one of those methods.
Right.
And if it's not in the book, then you would need to go somewhere else to look for.
So you were thinking about selling more books. Now
I was thinking about making it more, since it's called practical reliability engineering, not theoretical. So
well,
I decided to make it practical because people are working on those on those tasks.
Yeah.
In fact, this morning, just I had a phone call with my colleague who was asking me questions because their customer's asking for fit rates for connectors.
Right.
And again, and they don't have any idea how to approach this mm-hmm. because connectors are, well, I mean, they're a little bit different.
They're all complex too.
They are complex, and the approach you would take probably would be a little bit different from your kind of conventional electronics with a circuit board and a bunch of resistors, capacitors, and ICs there.
But, you know, I tend to see Pat's argument, and it's the same one I make about MTBF, and we're making progress on that, right? We're not seeing MTBF called out in some of the IEC standards anymore. They're writing it out of that. Unfortunately, ASQ still includes it, but it's not overt in the new body of knowledge. It's mentioned as a subnote. It's not called out as a main thing. Prediction has also been relegated more into a minor role. I think we're making progress, but I think one of the reasons I agree with Pat is just write it out of the book is that it's one of these chicken and the egg things. If it's in the book, then it must be a condoned and sanctioned practice, right? It's one of our tools. Even though in the standards themselves and in your book, it talks about it has limited utility. It has no practical capability to predict the future. It's good for A to B comparisons, for looking at different architectures, for in general. It's just that at the end of the day, we get a failure rate and somebody says, well, how good's my product? And you say, well, here's the only number I have. And nobody listens to how inaccurate it is. It's a number. We got it. We're move on. It gets misused. And I think that's where I've had so much angst around MTBF is that if the vendors are asking for MTBF, and if us as the reliability community said, that's a meaningless request, what do you really want? Or if they ask for a Telcordia prediction, or even worse, I've seen it in contracts this year where it says, we require a Mill Handbook 217 prediction. I always go back to them and say, why? What are you possibly going to use that for? And usually it's back to the procurement organization or somebody doing the contract and then go, this was written 10 years ago. It's a requirement. You just have to do it. We'll check it off. We know it's useless, but we're going to pay for it. You have to do it. Right.
Yeah. But you see, the reason I kept mentioning functional safety is because functional safety, like I said, gave it a new life, not because it's in our book or someone else's book. It's because they gave it a new use, and that use is you need to do reliability prediction and see if you actually meet the requirement that ASIL safety goal,
right.
Where you say, okay, your fit rate, your reliability prediction should be 10 fit. For classification D,
right.
And it should be 100 for B, and so on. So it's not like A to B comparison, but again, if you want to be in this business, you need to meet that requirement.
Well, is parts counts not the only way to do a prediction, though? What if you had a really solid physics of failure models for your system, and you can still calculate a fit rate?
Yeah, if you can do that, that's fine. In fact, the SAE committee, I'm a member of Automotive Electronics, we're trying to actually promote physics of failure approach.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you, there's a third approach, which I was kind of working on based on get the numbers based on field data,
mm-hmm.
because in our company, we've had pretty good databases where parts go through repair and the repair it goes to the level of individual components.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we generated our own database, and in fact this worked quite well, and the SAE committee, we released a standard which is SAEJ3083 on calculating, on doing basically reliability prediction, calculating fit rates based on the field return data. Like basically all that methodology we developed went into that standard where you have field return data, and if it's basically, if it contains reasonable information, then you can come up with fit rates, which will be, will still not be perfect and not going to be great, but they, they're going to be a lot, lot better and closer to what you see in the field than any of the handbooks.
Well, that's right. The handbook is not your design team. It's not your configuration and you know, product, and it's not in your application. And so by using that, narrowing it down and doing the work to get your own understanding of what's failing, not just to replace 20 parts and hope it works again and then record that you replaced 20 parts, that's not terribly useful. But doing a bit more due diligence on understanding what caused the failure and then tracking it is so valuable in this prediction world, and especially for in the safety sphere. I mean, at the end of the day, you want to understand, well, what's failing would cause an unsafe situation. It's, you would want to use the best available method to do that. And falling back to a simple parts count method just to get through the procedure is kind of, I think, tainting the safety standard and the intent of that standard right from the get-go.
Yeah, I probably would agree with you. But again, there's been some struggle between reliability and safety approaches when this new version of this ISO 26262, mm-hmm. functional safety for the automotive, was developing, because and one of the things was this failure rate calculations where safety people would like to see a lot more safety, meaning the parallel system, redundancy.
Right.
They call dual point failures.
Right.
Whereas as reliability engineers, we'd like to see our system as reliable as possible, where you would not need the redundancy. In fact, in the car, the vehicle, you can't really afford having redundancy.
Well, the same in aircraft, as you're adding weight and there's a constraint there. And a lot of our systems are actually really, really reliable. But I'm thinking of some systems. I'm thinking an inkjet printer, right? When they first came out, the inkjet head itself and the delivery of the ink to the nozzles was not terribly reliable. It would last about the time that you could do one ink cartridge full of ink pumped through it, and then it would degrade in its capability to print well. Well, that's improved over the years to now they're building in the nozzles, the expensive part, and you add ink separately and you get a longer life out of that. But it took time to develop that and understand it and realm. So there were calls at the start to say, well, make the nozzle integral to the printer and build it in. And it's not the same as a safety thing, but it was a cost of ownership issue. And they said, no, the big printers, how do you do two print heads and redundancy? How do you sense what hasn't printed correctly and reprint it? Kind of. But the safety world is, I think there's a disconnect there the way you described it, is that having a redundant system is not always safer. It adds more complexity, it adds more weight, it adds more cost, but it's not necessarily safer. Because we add other pieces to standby redundancy, or now we have sensors and switches that go from one system to another, and those things have to be reliable.
Right, and those things can fail as well. So
that's right.
If you can avoid redundancy, you must. I mean, some of the aerospace and avionics systems, you have to do some redundancy at some supercritical.
Well, you see it in communication systems and in navigation systems, where a single point, a failure of one system, it pretty much aborts. You have to abort the mission. You're done. You have to land. And so, having a backup system or a second computer on board or something allows you to continue. I think I've heard that the space shuttle had 5 navigation computers on it, all using different technology. And it was a part of the availability calculation, is that they needed to hit the atmosphere at the right angle.
Yeah. So, but again, going back to the automotive industry and probably many other industries, we can't afford redundancy. Mm-hmm. And again, this was a kind of disconnect with this functional safety standard. But tell the truth, if to summarize this whole reliability prediction thing, my impression it's here to stay, even though as we both agree, the value added is sort of questionable here. But based on trends I'm seeing, the functional safety, and also all this thing about self-driving vehicles, we'll see a lot more of that, and it becomes kind of part of this development process where OEM will be starting probably from making you as a supplier do reliability prediction, and then everything else comes later, and see if you meet the certain category or group or box or whatever.
Well, I think it's our individual choices, though, as organizations. Do we do the quick and easy parts count prediction and fiddle with the different standards and numbers until we get to join that business, right? We get to the right levels. I think at the end of the day, we've still got to make a safe system and a reliable system that meets those criteria. It's our choice, though. Do we invest in prognostic health management and physics of failure, understanding of our parts, and develop our own understanding of how our products fail and those things, and then convert it to a suitable thing for that standard? It's a choice. And I think the better organizations, the ones that will be successful, will understand their failure mechanisms, not out of a handbook, but because they understand it.
And like I said, our committee, Automotive Electronics Committee, SAE, we working on basically introducing the physics of failure approach to this whole functional safety thing.
Good.
Yeah, the physics of failure also has its limitations, because it seemed to prove its value when you're doing comparisons, like calculating failure rates and all those models. But it does have some limitations when you're trying to calculate the absolute numbers.
Like, that's right.
Okay, how many cycles, temperature cycles to failure will I have?
Right.
And that's not always easy question to answer, or how many stress reversals I'm going to have during this random vibration test until failure.
Right.
Again, we know like this SN curve, which would give you really good feel for if you go from, I don't know, 2G RMS to 4G RMS, how quicker the other one will fail. But again, if you're trying to calculate absolute number of cycles of stress reversals, then you may face some challenges doing that.
Well, let's end it with a quote after the George Box quote that all models are wrong and some are useful. You've probably heard the one, I think it was Casey Stengel, if I remember right, baseball coach, that said, you know, predictions are really difficult, especially about the future or something like that.
Yeah, I heard that attributed to Yogi Berra.
Yogi Berra, that's who I'm thinking of. Yeah.
He had a lot of good quotes.
That's right. And it's true. A lot of our business, I remember coming into reliability kind of out of a quality statistics world. And in regular statistics and in quality statistics, you never went beyond your data set. And the first task I got in reliability, well, what's the life of this product for 20 years? You only get 6 months to test it. And so I had to extrapolate immediately. And I eventually got over that, being uncomfortable about that, but never completely. This business of predicting in the world that we're in, and so many changes, so many variables, so many factors that affect the performance of our product, our models are wrong. But it goes back to what George said, it's some are useful. And using Mill Handbook 270 is not useful.
and that's what I think engineering is all about. We will never going to get to 100% or whatever, but we basically do the best we can, find the best models and and get the best data we have and produce the best product we can.
That's right.
So I think that's the bottom line here.
That's right. All right. Well, for our listeners, you know, Andre's kind of, I think you're ringing the alarm bell here, is that the safety world's keeping, in to a large degree, parts comp predictions available. And in your organization, do you do that? Do you use it? And do you use it appropriately? And we'll leave you to judge how you use it. But think about it. Is it serving you and your organization and in particular your customers? Or are you diving into more of the physics of failure approaches and understanding failure mechanisms, collecting and analyzing your field data so that it becomes a useful way for you to analyze your newer designs, or some other method? Let us know how you are approaching dealing with your products and estimating its future performance, its prediction in one form or another. You can head over to reliability.fm and you can find the Speaking of Reliability show along with the other shows in the podcast network, and leave us a comment or a note saying, you know, how do you approach this? How do you deal with it? And then furthermore, if you have any questions on what's a good approach or what's good for your circumstance or any of those kinds of things.
Read the book, Practical Reliability Engineering.
Yeah, that's right. That's
fifth edition.
That's right.
It's all there.
It's all there, and it gives you some good guidance and stuff. And, you know, let us know how it goes. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So thanks so much, Andre, for bringing that up. And I'm sure we're going to come back and talk about that. I'm sure we'll get some questions.
And thank you for doing this, Fred.
All right. No problem, Andre. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Kirk Gray here to mention that John Paskowitz and I published a book, Next Generation Halton Haas, Robust Design of Electronics and Systems, which provides the basics of applying Halton Haas and reveals how Halton Haas can discover software issues also. To find out more and get a copy, go to exendoreliability.com/go/halt.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.